On that very night you drank a human's blood, and have every night thereafter. Her face had not changed. The flesh was like the wax of ivory candles. Only the eyes showed life. There was nothing more to say to her. I set her down. "I took your life," I said. "He gave it back to you." "And here it is," she said under her breath. "And I hate you both." The vampire stopped. "But why did you tell her?" asked the boy after a respectful pause. "How could I not tell her?" The vampire looked up in mild astonishment. "She had to know it. She had to weigh one thing against the other. It was not as if Lestat had taken her full from life as he had taken me. I had stricken her. She would have died. There would have been no mortal life for her. But what's the difference? For all of us it's a matter of years, dying. So what she saw more graphically then was what all men knew, that death will come inevitably unless one chooses this." He opened his white hands now and looked at the palms. "And did you lose her? Did she go?"
"Go? Where would she have gone? She was a child, no bigger than that. Who would have sheltered her? Would she have found some vault, like a mythical vampire, lying down with worms and ants by day and rising to haunt some small cemetery and its surroundings? But that's not why she didn't go. Something in her was as akin to me as anything in her could have been. The thing in Lestat was the same. We could not bear to live alone. We needed our little company. A wilderness of mortals surrounded us, groping, blind, preoccupied, and the brides and bridegrooms of death." "Locked together in hatred," she said to me calmly afterwards. "I found her by the empty hearth, picking the small blossoms from a long stem of lavender. I was so relieved to see her there that I would have done anything, said anything. And when I heard her ask me in a low voice if I would tell her all I knew, I did this gladly. For all the rest was nothing compared to that old secret, that I had claimed her life. I told her of myself, as I've told you, of how Lestat came to me and what went on the night he carried her from the little hospital. She asked no questions, and only occasionally looked up from her flowers. And then, when it was finished and I was sitting there, staring again at that wretched skull and listening to the soft slithering of the petals of the flowers on her dress and feeling a dull misery in my limbs and mind, she said to me, 'I don't despise you.' I wakened. She slipped off the high, rounded damask cushion and came towards me, covered with the scent of flowers, the petals in her hand. 'Is this the aroma of mortal child?' she whispered. 'Louis? Lover?' I remember holding her, and burying my head in her small chest, crushing her bird shoulders, her small hands working into my hair, soothing me, holding me. 'I was mortal to you,' she said, and when I lifted my eyes I saw her smiling, but the softness on her lips was evanescent, and in a moment she was looking past me like someone listening for faint, important music. 'You gave me your immortal kiss,' she said, 'though not to me but to herself. You loved me with your vampire nature.' 'I love you now with my human nature, if ever I had it,' I said to her.
'Ah, yes,' she answered, still musing. 'Yes, and that's your flaw, and why your face was miserable when I said, as humans say, "I hate you," and why you look at me as you do now. Human nature. I have no human nature, and no short story of a mother's courts and hotel rooms where children learn monstrosity can give me one. I have none. Your eyes grow cold with fear when I say this to you. Yet I have your tongue, your passion for the truth,
Your need to drive the needle of the mind right to the heart of it all, like the beak of the hummingbird, who beats so wild and fast that mortals might think he had no tiny feet, could never set, just go from quest to quest, going again and again for the heart of it. I am your vampire self more than you are. And now the sleep of 65 years has ended. "This sleep of 65 years has ended," I heard her say it, disbelieving, not wanting to believe she knew and meant precisely what she'd said. For it had been exactly that since the night I tried to leave Lestat and failed, and, falling in love with her, forgot my teeming brain, my awful questions. And now she had the awful questions on her lips and must know. She'd strolled slowly to the center of the room and strewn the crumpled lavender all around her. She broke the brittle stem and touched it to her lips, and having heard the whole story, said, "He made me then to be your companion. No chains could have held you in your loneliness, and he could give you nothing. He gives me nothing. I used to think him charming. I liked the way he walked, the way he tapped the flagstones with his walking stick and swung me in his arms, and the abandon with which he killed, which was as I felt. But I no longer find him charming. And you never have. And we've been his puppets, you and I, you remaining to take care of him and I, your saving companion. Now's time to end it, Louis. Now's time to leave him." Time to leave him. I hadn't thought of it, dreamed of it, in so long. I'd grown accustomed to him, as if he were a condition of life itself. I could hear a vague mingling of sounds now, which meant he had entered the carriageway, that he would soon be on the back stairs. And I thought of what I always felt when I heard him coming, a vague anxiety, a vague need. And then the thought of being free of him forever rushed over me like water I'd forgotten, waves and waves of cool water. I was standing now, whispering to her that he was coming. "I know," she smiled. "I heard him when he turned the far corner." "But he'll never let us leave," I whispered, though I'd caught the implication of her words. Her vampire sense was keen. She stood en garde, magnificently. "But you don't know him if you think he'll let us leave," I said to her, alarmed at her self-confidence. "He will not let us go." And she, still smiling, said, "Oh, really?" It was agreed then to make plans, at once. The following night my agent came with his usual complaints about doing business by the light of one wretched candle, and took my explicit orders for an ocean crossing. Claudia and I would go to Europe, on the first available ship, regardless of what port we had to settle for, and paramount was that an important chest be shipped with us, a chest which might have to be fetched carefully from our house during the day and put on board, not in the freight, but in our cabin. And then there were arrangements for Lestat. I had planned to leave him the rents for several shops and townhouses and a small construction company operating in the Faubourg Marigny. I put my signature to these things readily. I wanted to buy our freedom, to convince Lestat we wanted only to take a trip together and that he could remain in the style to which he was accustomed. He would have his own money and need come to me for nothing. For all these years I'd kept him dependent on me. Of course he demanded his funds from me as if I were merely his banker, and thanked me with the most acrimonious words at his command, but he loathed his dependence. I hoped to deflect his suspicion by playing to his greed, and, convinced that he could read any emotion in my face, I was more than fearful. I did not believe it would be possible to escape him. Do you understand what that means? I acted as though I believed it, but I did not. Claudia, meantime, was flirting with disaster. Her equanimity overwhelming to me as she read her vampire books and asked Lestat questions. She remained undisturbed by his caustic outbursts, sometimes asking the same question over and over again in different ways and carefully considering what little information he might let escape in spite of himself. "What vampire made you what you are?" she asked without looking up from her book and keeping her lids lowered under his onslaught. "Why do you never talk about him?" she went on, as if his fierce objections were thin air. She seemed immune to his irritation.
"You're greedy, both of you," he said the next night, as he paced back and forth in the dark of the center of the room, turning a vengeful eye on Claudia, who was fitted into her corner, in the circle of her candle flame, her books in stacks about her. "Immortality is not enough for you. No, you would look the gift horse of God in the mouth. I could offer it to any man out there in the street, and he would jump for it."
"Did you jump for it?" she asked softly, her lips barely moving.
"But you would know the reason for it. Do you want to end it? I can give you death more easily than I gave you life."
He turned to me, her fragile flame throwing his shadow across me. It made a halo around his blonde hair and left his face, except for the gleaming cheekbone, dark.
"Do you want death?"
"Consciousness is not death," she whispered.
"Answer me! Do you want death?"
"And you give all these things. They proceed from you. Life and death," she whispered, mocking him.
"I have," he said. "I do."
"You know nothing," she said to him gravely, her voice so low that the slightest noise from the street interrupted it, might carry her words away, so that I found myself straining to hear her against myself as I lay with my head back against the chair. "And suppose the vampire who made you knew nothing, and the vampire who made that vampire knew nothing, and the vampire before him knew nothing. And so it goes back and back, nothing proceeding from nothing until there is nothing, and we must live with the knowledge that there is no knowledge."
"Yes,"
he cried out suddenly, his hands out, his voice tinged with something other than anger. He was silent. She was silent. He turned slowly as if I'd made some movement which alerted him, as if I were rising behind him.
"It reminded me of the way humans turn, when they feel my breath against them and know suddenly that where they thought themselves to be utterly alone, that moment of awful suspicion before they see my face and gasp."
He was looking at me now, and I could barely see his lips moving. And then I sensed it. He was afraid. Lestat afraid. And she was staring at him with the same level gaze, evincing no emotion, no thought.
"You infected her with this," he whispered.
He struck a match now with a sharp crackle and lit the mantel candles, lifted the smoky shades of the lamps, went around the room making light, until Claudia's small flame took on a solidity, and he stood with his back to the marble mantel, looking from light to light as if they restored some peace.
"I'm going out," he said.
She rose the instant he had reached the street, and suddenly she stopped in the center of the room and stretched, her tiny back arched, her arms straight up into small fists, her eyes squeezed shut for a moment and then wide open, as if she were waking to the room from a dream. There was something obscene about her gesture. The room seemed to shimmer with Lestat's fear, echo with his last response. It demanded her attention. I must have made some involuntary movement to turn away from her, because she was standing at the arm of my chair now and pressing her hand flat upon my book, a book I hadn't been reading for hours.
"Come out with me."
"You were right. He knows nothing. There is nothing he can tell us," I said to her.
"Did you ever really think that he did?"
she asked me in the same small voice.
"We'll find others of our kind," she said. "We'll find them in Central Europe. That is where they live in such numbers that the stories, both fiction and fact, fill volumes. I'm convinced it was from there that all vampires came, if they came from any place at all. We've tarried too long with him. Come out. Let the flesh instruct the mind." I think I felt a tremor of delight when she said these words. Let the flesh instruct the mind. Put books aside and kill, she was whispering to me. I followed her down the stairs, across the courtyard and down a narrow alley to another street. Then she turned with outstretched arms for me to pick her up and carry her, though, of course, she was not tired. She wanted only to be near my ear, to clutch my neck. I haven't told him my plan, about the voyage, the money, I was saying to her, conscious of something about her that was beyond me as she rode my measured steps, weightless in my arms.
He killed the other vampire, she said.
No. Why do you say this? I asked her. But it wasn't the saying of it that disturbed me, stirred my soul as if it were a pool of water longing to be still. I felt as if she were moving me slowly towards something, as if she were the pilot of our slow walk through the dark street.
Because I know it now, she said with authority. The vampire made a slave of him, and he would no more be a slave than I would be a slave, and so he killed him. Killed him before he knew what he might know, and then in panic made a slave of you. And you've been his slave.
Never really, I whispered to her. I felt the press of her cheek against my temple. She was cold and needed the kill. Not a slave, just some sort of mindless accomplice, I confessed to her, confessed to myself. I could feel the fever for the kill rising in me, a knot of hunger in my insides, a throbbing in my temples, as if the veins were contracting and my body might become a map of tortured vessels.
No, slave, she persisted in her grave monotone, as though thinking aloud the words, revelations, pieces of a puzzle. And I shall free us both.
I stopped. Her hand pressed me, urged me on. We were walking down the long, wide alley beside the cathedral, towards the lights of Jackson Square, the water rushing fast in the gutter down the centre of the alley, silver in the moonlight. She said,
I will kill him.
I stood still at the end of the alley. I felt her shift in my arm, move down as if she could accomplish being free of me without the awkward aid of my hands. I set her on the stone sidewalk. I said no to her. I shook my head. I had that feeling then which I described before, that the building around me, the cabildo, the cathedral, the apartments along the square, all this was silk and illusion, and would ripple suddenly in a horrific wind, and a chasm would open in the earth that was the reality. Claudia, I gasped, turning away from her.
And why not kill him?
She said now, her voice rising, silvery and finally shrill.
I have no use for him. I can get nothing from him, and he causes me pain which I will not abide.
And if he had so little use for us? I said to her. But the vehemence was false, hopeless. She was at a distance from me now, small shoulders straight and determined, her pace rapid, like a little girl who, walking out on Sundays with her parents, wants to walk ahead and pretend she is all alone. Claudia, I called after her, catching up with her in a stride. I reached for the small waist and felt her stiffen as if she had become iron. Claudia, you cannot kill him, I whispered. She moved backwards, skipping, clicking on the stones, and moved out into the open street. A cabriolet rolled past us with a sudden surge of laughter and the clatter of horses and wooden wheels. The street was suddenly silent. I reached out for her and moved forward over an immense space and found her standing at the gate of Jackson Square, hands gripping the wrought iron bars. I drew down close to her. I don't care what you feel, what you say. You cannot mean to kill him, I said to her.
And why not? Do you think him so strong? She said, her eyes on the statue in the square, two immense pools of light.
He is stronger than you know, stronger than you dream. How do you mean to kill him? You can't measure his skill, you don't know. I pleaded with her, but could see her utterly unmoved, like a child staring in fascination through the window of a toy shop.
Her tongue moved suddenly between her teeth and touched her lower lip in a strange flicker that sent a mild shock through my body. I tasted blood. I felt something palpable and helpless in my hands. I wanted to kill. I could smell and hear humans on the paths of the square, moving about the market along the levee. I was about to take her, making her look at me, shake her if I had to make her listen, when she turned to me with her great, liquid eyes. "I love you, Louis," she said. "Then listen to me, Claudia. I beg you," I whispered, holding her, pricked suddenly by a nearby collection of whispers, the slow rising articulation of human speech over the mingled sounds of the night. "He'll destroy you if you try to kill him. There is no way you can do such a thing for sure. You don't know how. And pitting yourself against him, you'll lose everything. Claudia, I can't bear this." There was a barely perceptible smile on her lips. "No, Louis," she whispered, "I can kill him. And I want to tell you something else now, a secret between you and me." I shook my head, but she pressed even closer to me, lowering her lids so that her rich lashes almost brushed the roundness of her cheeks. "The secret is, Louis, that I want to kill him. I will enjoy it." I knelt beside her, speechless, her eyes studying me as they'd done so often in the past. And then she said, "I kill humans every night. I seduce them, draw them close to me with an insatiable hunger, a constant, never-ending search for something. Something. I don't know what it is." She brought her fingers to her lips now and pressed her lips, her mouth partly open so I could see the gleam of her teeth. "And I care nothing about them, where they came from, where they would go, if I did not meet them on the way. But I dislike him. I want him dead and will have him dead. I shall enjoy it. But Claudia, he is not mortal. He's immortal. No illness can touch him. Age has no power over him. You threaten a life which might endure to the end of the world." "Ah, yes, that's it, precisely," she said with reverential awe. "A lifetime that might have endured for centuries. Such blood, such power. Do you think I'll process his power and my own power when I take him?" I was enraged now. I rose suddenly and turned away from her. I could hear the whispering of humans near me. They were whispering of the father and the daughter, of some frequent sight of loving devotion. I realized they were talking of us. "It's not necessary," I said to her. "It goes beyond all need, all common sense, all..."
"What? Humanity? He's a killer," she hissed. "Lone predator."
She repeated his own term, mocking it.
"Don't interfere with me or seek to know the time I choose to do it, nor try to come between us."
She raised her hand now to hush me, and caught mine in an iron grasp, her tiny fingers biting into my tight, tortured flesh.
"If you do, you will bring me destruction by your interference. I can't be discouraged."
She was gone then in a flurry of bonnet ribbons and clicking slippers. I turned, paying no attention to where I went, wishing the city would swallow me, conscious now of the hunger rising to overtake reason. I was almost loath to put an end to it. I needed to let the lust, the excitement, blot out all consciousness, and I thought of the kill over and over and over, walking slowly up this street and down the next, moving inexorably towards it, saying, "It's a string which is pulling me through the labyrinth. I am not pulling the string. The string is pulling me." And then I stood in the Rue Conti, listening to a dull thundering, a familiar sound. It was the fencers above, in the salon, advancing on the hollow wooden floor, forward, back again, scuttling, and the silver zinging of the foils. I stood back against the wall, where I could see them through the high, naked windows, the young men dueling late into the night, a left arm poised like the arm of a dancer. Grace advancing towards death, grace thrusting for the heart,
images of the young Frenier now driving the silver blade forward, now being pulled by it towards hell. Someone had come down the narrow wooden steps to the street, a young boy. A boy so young, he had the smooth, plump cheeks of a child. His face was pink and flushed from the fencing, and beneath his smart grey coat and ruffled shirt there was the sweet smell of cologne and salt. I could feel his heat as he emerged from the dim light of the stairwell. He was laughing to himself, talking almost inaudibly to himself, his brown hair falling down over his eyes as he went along, shaking his head, the whispers rising then falling off. And then he stopped short, his eyes on me. He stared, and his eyelids quivered, and he laughed quickly, nervously. "Excuse me," he said now in French. "You gave me a start." And then, just as he moved to make a ceremonial bow, and perhaps go around me, he stood still, and the shock spread over his flushed face. I could see the heart beating in the pink flesh of his cheeks, smell the sudden sweat of his young, taut body. "You saw me in the lamplight," I said to him, "and my face looked to you like the mask of death." His lips parted and his teeth touched, and involuntarily he nodded, his eyes dazed. "Pass by," I said to him. "Fast."
The vampire paused, then moved as if he meant to go on. But he stretched his long legs under the table and, leaning back, pressed his hands to his head as if exerting a great pressure on his temples. The boy, who had drawn himself up into a crouched position, his hands hugging his arms, unwound slowly. He glanced at the tapes and then back at the vampire.
"But you killed someone that night," he said.
"Every night," said the vampire.
"Why did you let him go, then?"
asked the boy.
"I don't know," said the vampire.
But he did not have the tone of truly, "I don't know," but rather, "let it be."
"You look tired," said the vampire. "You look cold."
"It doesn't matter," said the boy quickly. "The room's a little cold. I don't care about that. You're not cold, are you?"
"No."
The vampire smiled, and then his shoulders moved with silent laughter. A moment passed in which the vampire seemed to be thinking, and the boy to be studying the vampire's face. The vampire's eyes moved to the boy's watch.
"She didn't succeed, did she?" the boy asked softly.
"What do you honestly think?" asked the vampire.
He had settled back in his chair. He looked at the boy intently.
"That she was, as you said, destroyed," said the boy.
And he seemed to feel the words, so that he swallowed after he'd said the word destroyed.
"Was she?"
he asked.
"Don't you think that she could do it?"
asked the vampire.
"But he was so powerful. You said yourself you never knew what powers he had, what secrets he knew. How could she even be sure how to kill him? How did she try?"
The vampire looked at the boy for a long time, his expression unreadable to the boy, who found himself looking away, as though the vampire's eyes were burning lights.
"Why don't you drink from that bottle in your pocket?" asked the vampire. "It will make you warm."
"Oh, that," said the boy. I just...
The vampire laughed.
"You didn't think it was polite,"
he said, and he suddenly slapped his thigh.
"Well, that's true,"
the boy shrugged, smiling now, and he took the small flask out of his jacket pocket, unscrewed the gold cap, and took a sip. He held the bottle, now looking at the vampire.
"No,"
the vampire smiled and raised his hand to wave away the offer. Then his face became serious again, and, sitting back, he went on.
"Lestat had a musician friend in the Rue du Maine. We had seen him at a recital in the home of a Madame Leclerc, who lived there also, which was at that time an extremely fashionable street. And this Madame Leclerc, with whom Lestat was also occasionally amusing himself, had found the musician a room in another mansion nearby, where Lestat visited him often.
I told you he played with his victims, made friends with them, seduced them into trusting and liking him, even loving him, before he killed. So he apparently played with this young boy, though it had gone on longer than any other friendship I had ever observed. The young boy wrote good music, and often Lestat brought fresh sheets of it home and played the songs on the square grand in our parlour. The boy had a great talent, but you could tell that this music would not sell because it was too disturbing. Lestat gave him money and spent evening after evening with him, often taking him to restaurants the boy could have never afforded, and he bought him all the paper and pens which he needed for the writing of his music. As I said, it had gone on far longer than any such friendship Lestat had ever had, and I could not tell whether he had actually become fond of a mortal in spite of himself, or was simply moving towards a particularly grand betrayal and cruelty. Several times he'd indicated to Claudia and me that he was headed out to kill the boy directly, but he had not. And, of course, I never asked him what he felt, because it wasn't worth the great uproar my question would have produced. Lestat, entranced with a mortal. He probably would have destroyed the parlor furniture in a rage. The next night, after that which I just described to you, he jarred me miserably by asking me to go with him to the boy's flat. He was positively friendly, in one of those moods when he wanted my companionship. Enjoyment could bring that out of him. Wanted to see a good play, the regular opera, the ballet. He always wanted me along. I think I must have seen Macbeth with him 15 times. We went to every performance, even those by amateurs. And Lestat would stride home afterwards, repeating the lines to me, and even shouting out to passers-by with an outstretched finger, "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow," until they skirted him as if he were drunk. But this effervescence was frenetic and likely to vanish in an instant. Just a word or two of amiable feeling on my part, some suggestion that I found his companionship pleasant, could banish all such affairs for months, even years. But now he came to me in such a mood and asked me to go to the boy's room. He was not above pressing my arm as he urged me, and I, dull, catatonic, gave him some miserable excuse, thinking only of Claudia, of the agent, of imminent disaster. I could feel it and wondered that he did not feel it, and finally he picked up a book from the floor and threw it at me, shouting, "Read your damn poems, then! Rot!" And he bounded out. This disturbed me. I cannot tell you how it disturbed me. I wished him cold, impassive, gone. I resolved to plead with Claudia to drop this. I felt powerless and hopelessly fatigued, but her door had been locked until she left, and I had glimpsed her only for a second, while Lestat was chattering, a vision of lace and loveliness as she slipped on her coat, puffed sleeves again, and a violet ribbon on her breast, her white lace stockings showing beneath the hem of the little gown, and her white slippers immaculate. She cast a cold look at me as she went out. When I returned later, satiated and for a while too sluggish for my own thoughts to bother me, I gradually began to sense that this was the night. She would try tonight. I cannot tell you how I knew this. Things about the flat disturbed me, alerted me. Claudia moved in the back parlour behind closed doors, and I fancied I heard another voice there, a whisper. Claudia never brought anyone to our flat. No one did except Lestat, who brought his women of the streets. But I knew there was someone there, yet I got no strong scent, no proper sounds. And then there were aromas in the air of food and drink, and chrysanthemums stood in the silver vase on the square grand, flowers which to Claudia meant death. Then Lestat came, singing something soft under his breath, his walking stick making a rat-a-tat on the rails of the spiral stairs. He came down the long hall, his face flushed from the kill, his lips pink, and he set his music on the piano. "Did I kill him, or did I not kill him?" he flashed the question at me now with a pointing finger. "What's your guess?"
You did not, I said numbly, because you invited me to go with you, and would never have invited me to share that kill.
Ah, but did I kill him in a rage because you would not go with me? He said, and threw back the cover from the keys. I could see that he would be able to go on like this until dawn. He was exhilarated. I watched him flip through the music, thinking, can he die? Can he actually die? And does she mean to do this? At one point, I wanted to go to her and tell her we must abandon everything, even the proposed trip, and live as we had before. But I had the feeling now that there was no retreat. Since the day she'd begun to question him, this, whatever it was to be, was inevitable, and I felt a weight on me, holding me in the chair. He pressed two chords with his hands. He had an immense reach, and even in life could have been a fine pianist. But he played without feeling. He was always outside the music, drawing it out of the piano as if by magic, by the virtuosity of his vampire senses and control. The music did not come through him, was not drawn through him by himself.
"Well, did I kill him?" he asked me again. "No, you did not," I said again, though I could just as easily have said the opposite. I was concentrating on keeping my face a mask.
"You're right, I did not," he said. "It excites me to be close to him, to think over and over, I can kill him and I will kill him, but not now. And then to leave him and find someone who looks as nearly like him as possible. If he had brothers, why, I'd kill them one by one. The family would succumb to a mysterious fever which dried up the very blood in their bodies," he said, now mocking a Barker's tone. "Claudia has a taste for families. Speaking of families, I suppose you heard. The Frignières place is supposed to be haunted. They can't keep an overseer, and the slaves run away."
This was something I did not wish to hear in particular. Babette had died young, insane, restrained finally from wandering towards the ruins of Pointe-du-Lac, insisting she had seen the devil there and must find him. I'd heard of it in wisps of gossip. And then came the funeral notices. I'd thought occasionally of going to her, of trying some way to rectify what I had done, and other times I thought it would all heal itself, and in my new life of nightly killing I had grown far from the attachment I'd felt for her, or for my sister, or any mortal. And I watched the tragedy finally, as one might from a theatre balcony, moved from time to time, but never sufficiently to jump the railing and join the players on the stage. "Don't talk of her," I said.
"Very well. I was talking of the plantation, not her."
"Her, your lady love, your fancy," he smiled at me.
"You know, I had it all my way finally in the end, didn't I? But I was telling you about my young friend and how—"
"I wish you would play the music," I said softly, unobtrusively, but as persuasively as possible. Sometimes this worked with Lestat. If I said something just right, he found himself doing what I'd said. And now he did just that. With a little snarl, as if to say, "You fool," he began playing the music. I heard the doors of the back parlor open, and Claudia's steps move down the hall. "Don't come, Claudia," I was thinking, feeling. "Go away from it before we're all destroyed." But she came on steadily until she reached the hall mirror. I could hear her opening the small table drawer, and then the zinging of her hairbrush. She was wearing a floral perfume. I turned slowly to face her as she appeared in the door, still all in white, and moved across the carpet silently toward the piano. She stood at the end of the keyboard, her hands folded on the wood, her chin resting on her hands, her eyes fixed on Lestat. I could see his profile, and her small face beyond, looking up at him.
"What is it now?" he said, turning the page and letting his hand drop to his thigh. "You irritate me. Your very presence irritates me." His eyes moved over the page.
"Does it?" she said in her sweetest voice.
Yes, it does. And I'll tell you something else. I've met someone who'd make a better vampire than you do.
This stunned me. But I didn't have to urge him to go on.
Do you get my meaning? He said to her.
Is it supposed to frighten me?
She asked.
You're spoiled because you're an only child, he said. You need a brother. Or rather, I need a brother. I get weary of you both. Greedy, brooding vampires that haunt our own lives. I dislike it.
I suppose we could people the world with vampires, the three of us, she said.
You think so, he said, smiling, his voice with a note of triumph. Do you think you could do it? I suppose Louis has told you how it was done or how he thinks it was done. You don't have the power, either of you, he said.
This seemed to disturb her, something she had not accounted for. She was studying him. I could see she did not entirely believe him.
"And what gave you the power?"
she asked softly, but with a touch of sarcasm.
"That, my dear, is one of those things which you may never know, for even the Erebus in which we live must have its aristocracy."
"You're a liar,"
she said with a short laugh. And just as he touched his fingers to the keys again, she said,
"But you upset my plans."
"Your plans?" he asked.
"I came to make peace with you, even if you are the father of lies." "You're my father," she said. "I want to make peace with you. I want things to be as they were."
Now he was the one who did not believe.
He threw a glance at me, then looked at her.
"That can be. Just stop asking me questions. Stop following me. Stop searching in every alleyway for other vampires. There are no other vampires, and this is where you live and this is where you stay."
He looked confused for the moment, as if raising his own voice had confused him.
"I take care of you. You don't need anything.
And you don't know anything. And that is why you detest my questions. All that's clear. So now let's have peace, because there's nothing else to be had. I have a present for you."
"And I hope it's a beautiful woman with endowments you'll never possess," he said, looking her up and down. Her face changed when he did this. It was as if she almost lost some control I'd never seen her lose.
But then she just shook her head and reached out one small, rounded arm and tugged at his sleeve.
"I meant what I said. I'm weary of arguing with you. Hell is hatred, people living together in eternal hatred. We're not in hell. You can take the present or not, I don't care, it doesn't matter.
Only let's have an end to all this, before Louis in disgust leaves us both." She was urging him now to leave the piano, bringing down the wooden cover again over the keys, turning him on the piano stool until his eyes followed her to the door.
"You're serious?"
"Present? What do you mean, present?"
"You haven't fed enough. I can tell by your color, by your eyes. You've never fed enough at this hour. Let's say that I can give you a precious moment. Suffer the little children to come unto me," she whispered, and was gone. He looked at me. I said nothing. I might as well have been drugged. I could see the curiosity in his face, the suspicion. He followed her down the hall, and then I heard him let out a long, conscious moan, a perfect mingling of hunger and lust. When I reached the door, and I took my time, he was bending over the settee. Two small boys lay there, nestled among the soft velvet pillows, totally abandoned to sleep as children can be, their pink mouths open, their small, round faces utterly smooth. Their skin was moist, radiant, the curls of the darker of the two damp and pressed to the forehead. I saw at once by their pitiful and identical clothes that they were orphans, and they had ravaged a meal set before them on our best china. The tablecloth was stained with wine, and a small bottle stood half full among the greasy plates and forks.
but there was an aroma in the room I did not like. I moved closer, better to see the sleeping ones, and I could see their throats were bare but untouched. Lestat had sunk down beside the darker one. He was by far the more beautiful. He might have been lifted to the painted dome of a cathedral. No more than 7 years old, he had that perfect beauty that is of neither sex, but angelic. Lestat brought his hand down gently on the pale throat, and then he touched the silken lips. He let out a sigh which had again that longing, that sweet, painful anticipation.
"Oh, Claudia," he sighed, "you've outdone yourself. Where did you find them?"
She said nothing. She had receded to a dark armchair and sat back against two large pillows, her legs out straight on the rounded cushion, her ankles drooping so that you did not see the bottom of her white slippers, but the curved insteps and the tight, delicate little straps. She was staring at Lestat.
"Drunk on brandy wine," she said, "a thimbleful," and gestured to the table. "I thought of you when I saw them. I thought if I share this with him, even he will forgive."
He was warmed by her flattery. He looked at her now and reached out and clutched her white lace ankle.
"Ducky," he whispered to her and laughed, but then he hushed, as if he didn't wish to wake the doomed children. He gestured to her, intimately, seductively. "Come sit beside him. You take him, and I'll take this one. Come."
He embraced her as she passed and nestled beside the other boy. He stroked the boy's moist hair. He ran his fingers over the rounded lids and along the fringe of lashes, and then he put his whole softened hand across the boy's face and felt at the temples, cheeks, and jaw, massaging the unblemished flesh. He had forgotten I was there, or she was there, but he withdrew his hand and sat still for a moment, as though his desire was making him dizzy. He glanced at the ceiling and then down at the perfect feast. He turned the boy's head slowly against the back of the couch, and the boy's eyebrows tensed for an instant, and a moan escaped his lips. Claudia's eyes were steady on Lestat, though now she raised her left hand and slowly undid the buttons of the child who lay beside her and reached inside the shabby little shirt and felt the bare flesh. Lestat did the same, but suddenly it was as if his hand had life itself and drew his arm into the shirt and around the boy's small chest in a tight embrace, and Lestat slid down off the cushions of the couch to his knees on the floor, his arm locked to the boy's body, pulling it up close to him so that his face was buried in the boy's neck. His lips moved over the neck and over the chest and over the tiny nipple of the chest, and then putting his other arm into the open shirt so that the boy lay hopelessly wound in both arms, he drew the boy up tight and sank his teeth into his throat. The boy's head fell back, the curls loose as he was lifted, and again he let out a small moan and his eyelids fluttered, but never opened. And Lestat knelt. The boy pressed against him, sucking hard, his own back arched and rigid, his body rocking back and forth carrying the boy, his long moans rising and falling in time with a slow rocking, until suddenly his whole body tensed, and his hands seemed to grope for some way to push the boy away, as if the boy himself in his helpless slumber were clinging to Lestat. And finally he embraced the boy again, and moved slowly forward over him, letting him down among the pillows, the sucking softer, now almost inaudible. He withdrew. His hands pressed the boy down. He knelt there, his head thrown back, so the wavy blonde hair hung loose and disheveled. And then he slowly sank to the floor, turning, his back against the leg of the couch.
"Ah, God," he whispered, his head back, his lids half-masked. I could see the color rushing to his cheeks, rushing into his hands. One hand lay on his bent knee, fluttering, and then it lay still. Claudia had not moved. She lay like a Botticelli angel
beside the unharmed boy. The other's body already withered, the neck like a fractured stem, the heavy head falling now at an odd angle, the angle of death, into the pillow. But something was wrong. Lestat was staring at the ceiling. I could see his tongue between his teeth. He lay too still, the tongue, as it were, trying to get out of the mouth, trying to move past the barrier of the teeth and touch the lip. He appeared to shiver, his shoulders convulsing, then relaxing heavily. Yet he did not move. A veil had fallen over his clear grey eyes. He was peering at the ceiling. Then a sound came out of him. I stepped forward from the shadows of the hallway, but Claudia said in a sharp hiss, "Go back!"
"Louis,"
he was saying. I could hear it now.
"Louis! Louis! Don't you like it, Lestat?"
she asked him.
"Something's wrong with it,"
he gasped, and his eyes widened as if the mere speaking were a colossal effort. He could not move. I saw it. He could not move at all.
"Claudia,"
he gasped again, and his eyes rolled towards her.
"Don't you like the taste of children's blood?"
she asked softly.
"Louis,"
he whispered, finally lifting his head just for an instant. It fell back on the couch.
"Louis, it's absinthe. Too much absinthe,"
he gasped.
"She's poisoned them with it. She's poisoned me, Louis."
He tried to raise his hand. I drew nearer the table between us.
"Stay back,"
she said again. And now she slid off the couch and approached him, peering down into his face as he had peered at the child.
"Absinthe, father," she said. "And laudanum." "Demon," he said to her. "Louis, put me in my coffin."
He struggled to rise.
"Put me in my coffin."
His voice was hoarse, barely audible. The hand fluttered, lifted, and fell back.
"I'll put you in your coffin, father,"
she said, as though she were soothing him.
"I'll put you in it forever."
And then, from beneath the pillows of the couch, she drew a kitchen knife.
"Claudia, don't do this thing,"
I said to her. But she flashed at me a virulency I'd never seen in her face, and as I stood there paralyzed, she gashed his throat, and he let out a sharp, choking cry.
"God!"
he shouted out.
"God!"
The blood poured out of him down his shirt front, down his coat. It poured as it might never pour from a human being, all the blood with which he had filled himself before the child and from the child. And he kept turning his head, twisting, making the bubbling gash gape. She sank the knife into his chest now, and he pitched forward, his mouth wide, his fangs exposed, both hands convulsively flying towards the knife, fluttering around its handle, slipping off its handle. He looked up at me, the hair falling down into his eyes.
"Louis! Louis!"
He let out one more gasp and fell sideways on the carpet. She stood looking down at him. The blood flowed everywhere like water. He was groaning, trying to raise himself, one arm pinned beneath his chest, the other shoving at the floor. And now, suddenly, she flew at him and, clamping both arms about his neck, bit deep into him as he struggled.
"Louis! Louis!"
he gasped over and over, struggling, trying desperately to throw her off. But she rode him, her body lifted by his shoulder, hoisted and dropped, until she pulled away. And finding the floor quickly, she backed away from him, her hands to her lips, her eyes for the moment clouded, then clear. I turned away from her, my body convulsed by what I'd seen, unable to look any longer.
"Louis,"
she said, but I only shook my head. For a moment the whole house seemed to sway, but she said,
"Look what's happening to him."
He had ceased to move. He lay now on his back, and his entire body was shriveling, drying up, the skin thick and wrinkled and so white that all the tiny veins showed through it. I gasped, but I could not take my eyes off it. Even as the shape of the bones began to show through, his lips drawing back from his teeth, the flesh of his nose drying to two gaping holes. But his eyes, they remained the same, staring wildly at the ceiling, the irises dancing from side to side even as the flesh cleaved to the bones, became nothing but a parchment wrapping for the bones. The clothes hollow and limp over the skeleton that remained. Finally, the irises rolled to the top of his head, and the whites of his eyes went dim. The thing lay still. A great mass of wavy blonde hair, a coat, a pair of gleaming boots. And this horror that had been Lestat, and I staring helplessly at it. For a long time, Claudia merely stood there. Blood had soaked the carpet, darkening the woven wreaths of flowers. It gleamed sticky and black on the floorboards. It stained her dress, her white shoes, her cheek. She wiped at it with a crumpled napkin, took a swipe at the impossible stains of the dress, and then she said, "Louis, you must help me get him out of here."
I said, "No." I'd turned my back on her, on the corpse at her feet.
"Are you mad, Louis? It can't remain here," she said to me. "And the boys, you must help me. The other one's dead from the absinthe. Louis!"
I knew that this was true, necessary, and yet it seemed impossible. She had to prod me then, almost lead me every step of the way. We found the kitchen stove still heaped with the bones of the mother and daughter she'd killed, a dangerous blunder, a stupidity. So she scraped them out now into a sack and dragged the sack across the courtyard stones to the carriage. I hitched the horse myself, shushing the groggy coachman, and drove the hearse out of the city, fast in the direction of the Bayou Saint-Jean, towards the dark swamp that stretched to Lake Pontchartrain. She sat beside me, silent, as we rode on, until we'd passed the gaslit gates of the few country houses, and the shell road narrowed and became rutted, the swamp rising on either side of us, a great wall of seemingly impenetrable cypress and vine. I could smell the stench of the muck, hear the rustling of the animals. Claudia had wrapped Lestat's body in a sheet before I would even touch it, and then, to my horror, she had sprinkled it over with the long-stemmed chrysanthemums, so it had a sweet funereal smell as I lifted it last of all from the carriage. It was almost weightless, as limp as something made of knots and cords, as I put it over my shoulder and moved down into the dark water, the water rising and filling my boots, my feet seeking some path in the ooze beneath, away from where I'd laid the two boys. I went deeper and deeper in with Lestat's remains, though why I did not know. And finally, when I could barely see the pale space of the road and the sky which was coming dangerously close to dawn, I let his body slip down out of my arms into the water. I stood there, shaken, looking at the amorphous form of the white sheet beneath the slimy surface. The numbness which had protected me since the carriage left the Rue Royale threatened to lift and leave me flayed suddenly, staring, thinking, "This is Lestat. This is all of transformation and mystery, dead, gone into eternal darkness." I felt a pull, suddenly, as if some force were urging me to go down with him, to descend into the dark water and never come back. It was so distinct and so strong that it made the articulation of voices seem only a murmur by comparison. It spoke without language, saying, "You know what you must do. Come down into the darkness, let it all go away." But at that moment I heard Claudia's voice. She was calling my name. I turned, and through the tangled vines I saw her distant and tiny, like a white flame on the faint luminescent shell road. That morning she wound her arms around me, pressed her head against my chest in the closeness of the coffin, whispering she loved me. That we were free now of Lestat forever. "I love you, Louis," she said over and over as the darkness finally came down with the lid and mercifully blotted out all consciousness. When I awoke, she was going through his things.
It was a tirade, silent, controlled, but filled with a fierce anger. She pulled the contents from cabinets, emptied drawers onto the carpets, pulled one jacket after another from his armoires, turning the pockets inside out, throwing the coins and theatre tickets and bits and pieces of paper away. I stood in the door of his room, astonished, watching.